This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 1st of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 217 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tugg.
On today's show, we'll ask the veteran broadcast journalist Stuart Purvis when, if ever, it's acceptable for journalists to cross the line in the interests of pursuing a story.
I don't want public trials of journalists, I don't want show trials, but I want journalists to ask themselves, could I justify what I'd done? And in some cases, could I even keep a straight face justifying what I'd done?
And we'll talk cheating with a sports writer who's covered the last six Summer Olympics. Mike Rowbottom, author of Foul Play, The Dark Arts of Cheating in Sport, will be joining us.
And then... yes, cats. John Bradshaw, world expert in animal behaviour and author of Cat Sense, will be here to talk us through the feline enigma.
That is all to come, plus Tom Edwards with next week's news. Look ahead, I can hear his whiskers twitching through the glass. And of course, some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. I was personally looking forward to the montage that took place in that first introductory section, Andrew. I wondered what their musical accompaniment was going to be for the cat thing.
You wanted Top Cat, didn't you?
Yeah, I wanted Top Cat. That's what you've just played. I've just been blasting it out in the office.
I know.
Right? That's what I kind of wanted. But never mind. We're going to see. I expect there'll be more from that medley, that cat medley later on in the show. That's one of the main things I'm looking forward to. We've got actual human guests, obviously, and we've got each other's company. But man, I love a cat medley.
But I don't think that he's going to be bringing in any cats.
That's right, because do you know what?
What?
Don't like cats. And look, looking through the book on cats, there is a thing on cat phobia. So I can ask him about that. Why do people not like them?
Are you scared of them?
Slightly scared of them, and I don't really, you know.
You just don't get on.
Don't really get on. I was thinking I'm going to get scratched. But anyway, we can say, yeah.
Well, actually, because you and me are both in the kind of more dog world.
We're in the dog zone, aren't we? We're in the dog house.
We're in the dog house.
We're here on a Sunday, Andrew. It's the dog house. It's Monocle Weekly.
We're certainly in the dog house.
We're going to review our week very quickly. It's been a really busy week, hasn't it? But I've quite enjoyed it.
Yes, a very, very busy week. And next week, where are you? Are you going to Berlin or are you going to
Amsterdam? I'm not going to Berlin because we're going to Toronto now for the film festival.
Okay, so Berlin next week for all our listeners. If you're a subscriber, or if you're not, I think, we have an event in Berlin next Thursday, which is at the Gestalten Space, which is for launch of the Monocle book.
It's with deserved fanfare, I think, as well. Yes. We've got a copy of it here in the studio. This, by the way, is how it sounds when you just... This is the Monocle Gestalten book, the Monocle Guide to Better Living. This is just me casually putting it down on the Monocle 24 playlist. That's brilliant. You see, they didn't think of that.
No,
exactly. I think that was someone's tail got caught there.
It's very nice. It's very yellow and it's very big.
It is. It's genuinely big and beautiful. And all the hard work, it sort of finally has come home to roost, right? It seems pretty good.
And you have an amazing culture section in there.
Is it? Well, it is quite good. It looks quite cool. I'm actually rather pleased with it.
It should be.
It's cool. It's been a week of kind of like ticking off the October issue. I mean that not in the sense of it's been bad and it has to sit in the doghouse with us. Not in that sense ticked off, but it's gone out of the building. But also it's quite kind of nice making sort of party plans, isn't it? For the book.
Yes.
I'm sorry for the book.
I thought you were going to tell us about your personal life again.
I'm not talking about talking about the pants party.
We start in Berlin. And the following week, we're going to be back in London here at Midori House. We're going to have an event for the book here. And then we cross over to Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And then there's a team with Tyler goes to Asia. There's going to be a launch in
Japan.
Team Lash Up, Hong Kong,
okay.
Japan.
Nice. It's going to be fun, isn't it? I don't want to bring what should be essentially a text message into the Monocle Weekly, the radio programme, but I invited Ben to come to the party in London. That'd be all right, right? That's all right. You know what happens.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Right. Well, what's going to happen next? It's the news look ahead with Tom Edwards. I expect things like, can Ben come to the party? That'll probably be one of the main items of his news. It's big, important stuff.
It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. With his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
So, Tom, before we do anything, are you kind of like cat man, dog man?
Used to be a cat man. Now I'm a dog man.
That's unusual.
You know this, Andrew Tuck, because, of course, I was converted by Wirehead Fox Terriers, which you yourself have.
Do they sort of hold you down and wag in your face?
Yeah, they're the zealots of the dog world.
Are they?
Yeah.
They're like the Jehovah's Witness. They come and knock around on the door.
They're constantly
knocking,
showing me pamphlets about all the beautiful things God has to offer.
very disappointing about the world of dogs. We've had that dog 1 year. Doesn't do a thing. Ignores you. We had a friend come and stay one night. Now does give me your paw. He taught that damn dog.
He does
dog.
Give me your paw.
He does not the friend, the dog. Dog learnt that trick in one day when we were out.
Oh no, that's
well,
really annoying.
Andrew,
isn't
what
it?
You don't know is
that's kind of like your...
How has he coaxed the dog into doing that? Probably there's some kind of bribery going on.
Or a big stick.
Is it the stick or the carrot?
Anyway.
Dogs don't even eat carrots.
That's kind of like going out of the house and then when you come back, you kind of your babysitter's heard your son's first words. Isn't it? It's a bit like that. It's like, oh, shit. You know, that's not good, is it?
How many times has that happened to you, Rob?
All the time.
Yeah, I thought it might.
I keep on having to pretend I've got stories to go and do while I go around the world, Tom. It's fine.
Okay.
Where are you going to start with your news?
When should we start? What about on Thursday?
When should we start? Where should we start, even?
When and where? How about on Thursday in St. Petersburg, the 8th G20 summit? Of course, meeting to discuss various matters of international importance. But I think one that's quite interesting, with everything that's kind of ongoing at the moment involving Syria, and there's differences of opinion, obviously, between Russia and the rest of the international community, will be exactly how they tackle those disagreements at this kind of event. There's all sorts of little, behind-the-scenes bilateral discussions that take place. I just think it'd be quite interesting to see exactly what happens, particularly between the US and Russia, because it was obviously so much animus anyway because of the Edward Snowden disagreements and all these other diplomatic problems, before we even get onto the big picture items like what's happening in Syria. So always intriguing to ponder the dynamics between all these world leaders when they get together.
And who goes? Does President Obama go?
Oh, yeah, they'll all be there.
But I thought he was going to avoid him, Mr. Putin. Didn't
well,
like
he cancelled
him so much.
He cancelled a private meeting, but I don't think he can just not... I think he can unilaterally not appear at the G20. People would realise that was a miss.
Do you think he can unilaterally not appear? Or do you think the word unilaterally should be applied to sort of other proper verbs?
Well,
it's a no-show.
So if you're choosing to do a quibble, Rob, you're probably right.
Will Vladimir be unilaterally wearing a shirt, do you think?
Possibly.
Okay, I hope so. I'm getting a bit fed up with those pictures of him walking around just in cargo pants.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's very popular. It plays well back home, I gather.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Yeah, no. It goes clean over my head, that. I don't know. I'm not.
That's probably the best place for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Move us on.
Well, I wanted to keep it in Russia, actually, because on Friday, it's the Moscow mayoral elections. We perhaps wouldn't always get super excited about that, except it's interesting that Alexei Navalny, one of the leading dissidents, who, of course, was convicted in this trumped-up embezzlement charge last month, and he is trying to succeed in getting into this office in Russia, and he's going to actually be allowed to hold some campaigning rallies, and they very generously allowed him to do so, which is something of a surprise, because ordinarily they try and disrupt his bids to raise funding and raise his profile, but they're allowing him to do that. So that's something we'll pick up later in the week, looking at his rallies, maybe going along and seeing exactly what the dynamic is there, because it's obviously quite a fragile situation for him.
Good. Well, I saw a very nice picture this week, which was, did you see the story about in St. Petersburg, they had an art exhibition. There was a painting up for 2 weeks. No one noticed for 2 weeks. Then somebody realised it was a kind of painting of Putin with his kind of arm resting on Medvedev's shoulder. But they were both done as like women in kind of 90s. And he was giving him a kind of like a loving caress.
Nice.
Not surprisingly, apparently the artist has fled.
Has he?
Probably sensible. I like that. A bit of sort of... dissident art. It's always good.
Yeah, exactly.
Always welcome. And then I thought I should mention one other thing, which is the Australian federal elections, of course. That's taking place at the weekend. We're going to be looking ahead to that all week with the various special features on our programmes on March
24. Is that the general election? That's the presidential
election. This is the big deal for, deciding the political direction that Australia is going to go in. And there's a couple of interesting things. One is that, of course, Australia has... mandatory voting, which I always think is quite interesting, and they get very high levels of turnout. I think the last election it was somewhere in the 90s percentage-wise.
What if you don't vote?
You get a fine. Mm. It's not big, about $20. There's also a number of bookmakers in Australia have paid out on victory already, so they're obviously confident that the results are only going to go one way. I think there's still quite a lot of battles to be fought.
And I'm sure you'll be kind of running lots of analysis and check-ins across the week on Monocle 24.
Absolutely, yeah. The Globalist is the place for that. We've got a special series looking ahead all during the week, and then we'll be responding and reacting once the polls are closed.
That is exciting, Tom. I like your three. That was a.
It was quite
I think
newsy.
It was an appropriate mix of light and shade.
Absolutely.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London,
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
From London,
in London,
London, cara.
De Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Some nice voices there, Andrew. I like Corinna, who's the German lady at the beginning.
And Santiago.
Santiago at the end. Sort of sounding rather sultry. Corinna at the beginning, sounding, that's a kind of sexy German accent she's got there.
I was in Stockholm recently and someone was asking me at Monocle 24 and they said, who's the angry Spaniard? he's not Spanish. He's
you just say SRT at Monocle. Like, deal
you
mean
with Santiago. He's like, yeah. We love him, but he always sounds a bit angry.
He's a bit gruff. It's like someone's phoned him up and he's kind of had to roll out of bed. Sounds like a Spaniard in his sleep, maybe murmuring.
Anyway,
how are we going to get that serious news?
I don't know. I think that I don't think we can. But
well, then we're going to try. Let's try.
Just jar our way into the next gear.
When I was playing records on the radio doing the Atlantic shift. I think this was brought up by one of the newsreaders. How am I going to go from that to Syria? And I was just like, do it with your voice. You're a pro. Come on, be a pro with it.
Right, you change your voice.
Okay. Up next on the Monocle Weekly, we're talking about the good, the bad, and the occasionally ugly world of media. Stuart Purvis is Professor of Journalism at City University in London, and in his long and illustrious career in broadcast media, including stints as the editor of Britain's Channel 4 News, editor-in-chief and CEO of ITN, as well as a senior regulatory role at Ofcom. He's recently been invited onto the board of Channel 4.
Stuart stopped by here at Midori House to speak with our news editor, Tom Edwards, a little earlier. On the agenda was the subject of press freedom, and in particular, the issue of self-regulation. The question of when, if ever, it's acceptable for journalists to cross the line in the interest of pursuing a story. This vexed question is the subject of a new book by Purvis and his colleague, Jeff Holbert, called Crossing the Line. Tom first sought Stuart's views on the apparent attack earlier this week on the New York Times' website by pro-government elements in Syria.
Well, this is the Syrian Electronic Army, which I think everyone presumes has got something to do with the Syrian government, though it's never been actually proved. They've been busy hacking into the websites of news organisations that they regard as unsympathetic to Syria. And the latest victim is the New York Times. And I think what's extraordinary about this is the detail which the Syrian hackers appear to have and able to get into these pretty important sites. So this, we know that they got in via kind of back door in Australia, a supplier to New York Times of various electronic services. Somebody found a password in that way. And you kind of wonder, well, you know, is this a couple of people just doing this or have they got sympathisers in other places? And I suppose if the attack on Syria from the West goes ahead, is there any other kind of retaliation? I mean, in truth, they're a nuisance at the moment, and they're kind of rather pathetic. They kind of leave messages saying the Syrian Electronic Army was here, like you would do on a kind of toilet wall or something. But, you know, are they capable of actually doing something quite seriously disruptive? We'll wait and see.
Because it is interesting. I wonder what their agenda is. Is it the nuisance value fundamentally? I mean, at this stage, there's no sense that they're trying to sort of get in and change articles or change presentation and look at shaping a sort of editorial appearance. It does seem to be more nuisance. I mean, is there any sense that with a more concerted effort, they would be able to do that kind of thing?
Some of the access that they've achieved so far, if they were kind of quite smart, they could be fiddling with articles, should we say, and interfering with them. But they seem to be looking for profile, don't they? They seem to want to be noticed. They seem to want to know that we Syrians don't like what you Western media say about us and we can get back at you. Whether there's another level that they could take it to, on the evidence so far, not. But, you know, given that they do seem to be able to find their way through some back doors, I think news organisations are definitely on the watch for them.
Absolutely, they'll be very wary. And it's interesting, I suppose, when we turn to look at the British press in particular, they appear to have jumped to the conclusion is an inevitable involvement of the UK in some kind of strike on Syria. Why do you think that the British press seems to be of such an accord on this? Is it because the experiences we've seen in Iraq or in Afghanistan are still very fresh? As a sort of expert on the way that these people make their decisions, why do you think they all seem to have fallen into
well,
order?
There's two different things going on here, Tom. First of all, it is quite striking how uniform the British press were, in without taking sides, just saying there's going to be an attack. Now, this story didn't seem to be anywhere else. It certainly wasn't in the American press. It wasn't really in the British broadcasters. It looks as though Downing Street in London got a group of newspaper correspondents to one side and gave them a specific briefing, and they all ran off and said there's going to be an attack. And then, you know, next day, John Kerry sort of said, well, maybe there will be. It looks almost as if Fleet Street, as we call it, was setting the, you know, the world's diplomatic agenda. But then the interesting thing was, having said that, they then said, well, actually, we don't agree with an attack, or most of them. I think there's one or two exceptions. And the most popular newspaper, The Sun, which had a headline a couple of days ago saying kick his ass or kick his ass, is now sort of saying, oh, but maybe, you know, maybe we shouldn't. So I think that the root of this is the Iraq invasion. I think that the British media felt it was suckered by Tony Blair into supporting his invasion of Iraq, and they are sceptical about this invasion. Not that it's going to be an invasion. It's obviously just going to probably be a missile attack if it happens at all. Probably what then happens is a kind of patriotic spirit kicks in. And they may have said, well, we were against it, but now it happens. We support our boys and girls in the armed forces. So be prepared for yet another shift of opinion, maybe.
Do you think there's a difference perhaps between what in some pieces refers to the sort of gung-ho headlines that we sometimes get with the actual sort of editorial opinion? You know, you read the op-eds, they're rather more considered, nuanced, balanced. Do you think there is sometimes a bit of a divergence between how these things are presented, at least on the front pages, and what the actual people putting the news together really think? And if so, why does that come about? Because it can be kind of rather misleading.
British newspapers are compartmentalised. I mean, American newspapers are even more compartmentalised, so that the people who write the leaders barely meet the people who write the newspapers. But you've got the what they call the splash subs. They're the ones looking for the big headline on the front page that's going to sell newspapers. You then particularly got the columnists. So, for instance, in the Daily Mail, and you know, a leading mid-market paper, they have a very strongly right-wing agenda. But actually, what's interesting about this story, it seems to unite the left wing and the right wing as being sceptical about an attack. And then you've got the leader writers, a rather sort of, how can I say, rather exclusive bunch who sort of lunch in the best restaurants and then come back with their considered thoughts. And they don't always think the same things as the people writing the front page splash.
Undercover reporting's also come into sharp focus for a number of reasons. And in particular, I guess, in the aftermath of all the sort of inquiries that we've had in this country, there's been a lot of sense about what lengths should reporters go to? Where does the public interest end and simply, you know, bad journalism or malpractice, even criminal behaviour, begin?
It's certainly a very striking headline. Basically, the allegation is that a woman reporter had sex with somebody to get a story. Now, I'm not saying that hasn't happened before. There used to be a phrase in British tabloid journalism was that you would make your excuses and leave. In other words, you might imply that you were going to have sex with somebody, but actually then leave before it happened. Well, on this occasion, no one appears to have made their apologies and left. This is the Sunday Times. This is not a kind of, you know, tabloid newspaper. It's a, you know, mainstream, serious Sunday paper. And they definitely had a good purpose, which was to try to expose what's become known as female genital mutilation, in other words, circumcision of young women. They were trying to prove that a certain person did it. But the allegation is, from his side, that the woman reporter offered him sex to try to prove the story. I don't know of any rules that say you shouldn't actually do that. The newspaper denies that she admits that she did. But it's definitely a sort of a new, whether it's a new low or a new high in journalistic ethics, I don't know, but it's certainly a new line.
Now, it's interesting, Stuart, because obviously you've been writing a book about, well, rather this issue about, you know, where are these parameters for journalists, this sort of line that exists and at what point it is crossed, whether it's acceptable or not. I mean, what's your take? Do you think that these are things, as you alluded to in your last answer, that have always been happening in one sense or another? Or is there a sense that this is a part of an industry that is almost unravelling? What's your sort of considered view, having been sort of investigating
it's time? It's a bit of both, Tom. But I've been around journalism sort of off and on for about four decades, and I've heard this phrase crossing the line, you know, that certain thing crossed the line. And so I kind of tried to pin down, well, what is this line? And what emerges is that reporters in general don't like rules and regulations. And quite often they don't even know what the rules and regulations are, but they have some kind of moral compass. And crossing line is if they go at a moral compass. In reality, sometimes the story, you know, getting the story and particularly beating the competition to a story and getting an exclusive kind of overrides these lines. I've ended up, after spending off and on 10 years on this project, writing this 400-page book, with saying there isn't really a line, other than Are you prepared to stand up in a public place and be questioned, Mr. or Miss Reporter, about why you did this? And that's one of the sort of unexpected benefits of the Leveson inquiry into press standards in Britain, is that certain reporters were called up and said in public, did you do this? And if you did it, why did you do it? So I don't want public trials of journalists. I don't want show trials, but I want journalists to ask themselves, if that happened to me, what would I actually say? And could I actually, you know, could I justify what I'd done? And in some cases, could I even keep a straight face justifying what I'd done?
Sure, it's interesting. I mean, you make that point at the beginning there about they perhaps don't even really understand what the parameters are. Is somebody somewhere culpable for that? I mean, where does this failing rest? Is it within the institutions of media? You mentioned Fleet Street. Is it about how people are trained, or oftentimes are they simply not getting the kind of training that perhaps they should have? Where do you, is there a fault here, perhaps?
It's a fair question, because my experience, I'm one of the few editors who's also been a regulator. So I worked for the British broadcast regulator, Ofcom. My job was to enforce the rules. And quite often I would say to my colleagues still in broadcasting, do you know that there actually is a rule about this particular subject? And the answer was that they didn't. Now, their answer is, I'm too busy getting the story to read the rules. So what seems to have happened was, within most sensible organisations, they've made one person the job title something called head of compliance. Their job is to find out what on earth's going on in their news organisation and make sure whether it does or doesn't break the rules. But the further twist is, on some occasions now, we find that what look like breaches of the rules can actually be justified if they're in the public interest. And in the book, I give some test cases that have run through where people didn't know there was a rule, broke the rule, but actually once they'd found the broke the rule, had a reason why they'd broken the rule. So that's why it's such an uncertain art or science.
Obviously, this has been the subject of so much discussion, particularly here in the UK, in the light of Leveson and these other inquiries, talking about regulation of the press. In your view, what do you think we should be looking at? Is it about independent bodies to oversee it? Is it about people, as you said, being sort of truer to their own sense, asking themselves those difficult questions? You know, would you be willing to sort of back yourself and speak out publicly? Is there a role for regulation? Is it about education? I mean, where do you think we should turn if we want some more answers, if we still feel that what's been done so far perhaps still isn't quite enough?
I think it all comes down to this phrase, independent self-regulation, because at one level, you can have those words in the same phrase, because if it's a self-regulator, that normally means it's run by the industry itself. And that's the way it was done in Britain and is done in many countries. Of course, in the United States, they don't even have anything like this at all, such as the belief about in the First Amendment. So if you have a self-regulator, how can it be independent? And that's really the struggle we've had in Britain. I think it comes down to the symbolic chair of the regulator, of the self-regulator. Who decides who that person is? What we've had in Britain is that person being chosen by the industry themselves and, frankly, playing along with what the industry want. We need a process where that person is absolutely independent. Even if they're paid by the industry, even if they spend lots of time dealing with industry, they need to know that if they upset the industry, they're not going to lose their job.
And it intrigues me when we compare, if we sort of look across the whole landscape of media, some industries seem to be better at doing this, or there seems to be less of a fraught process. We look on television, people often say, well, that works better. People adhere more closely to the guidelines and strictures. I guess it's a twofold thing. Do you think that is the case? And if it is, why is that? Is it something to do with the crusading tradition of print journalism that seems to set it apart? Or do you think it's actually, there are more similarities perhaps than appear at first?
Sometimes the phrase is used about the Wild West to talk about the online world. Sometimes I think, you know, British tabloid journalism has been in a kind of Wild West for many years. I feel that there is a way forward here in which you can maintain the kind of, shall we say, ruthlessness in trying to do a tough investigation. But I don't see that this is exclusive to newspapers. I think what it comes across in my book, When Reporters Cross the Line, is actually broadcasters themselves have run some pretty tough investigations. And I have to say, have often fallen out with their regulators about it. So having been an editor and a regulator, I don't believe that regulation is a kind of answer to all problems, because sometimes it can be a form of censorship. So I see print, broadcasting and online as closer than they've ever been in what they're trying to do. The fact is there'll never be one system that covers all three, and maybe that's not such a bad thing.
That was Stuart Purvis with Tom Edwards on press freedom and self-regulation. Oh, we're going to have a song now, Andrew. It's like the olden days. Because we get a bit mixed up, the kind of thing happened, you don't quite know, da, 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 da. But now it's nice to sort of pick a song. We're kind of coming to the end of the summer. I've heard this a lot on the radio this summer. Played it a bit on the radio, Monocle 24 this summer. I think it's time we heard it again.
And what is it?
It's called Cool by Le Youth. It sounds like a made-up thing. You're going to love this, isn't it? That was Le Youth with Cool. Did that? Do you think it lived up to its name?
I rather like that.
It's pretty cool. It is a good song. I think they're a duo out of Los Angeles, California. It's good. Always the summertime there. You are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly. We'll continue with a talk on foul play in sport. Stay tuned.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
In sports, there's cheating and then there's cheating. Sometimes it's completely unacceptable, like in the case of doping. Sometimes cheating is just about fine when the question is more about bending the rules. But where do you draw the line between cheating that's a complete no-no and cheating that's kind of fine? There are a lot of grey areas in sports, and this is something that's intrigued our next guest, Mike Rowbottom.
Mike has worked as a sports writer for over two decades, and he has covered the past six Olympics Games. Now he has written the book Foul Play, The Dark Arts of Cheating in Sport, and he joins us on the line now from France. Hello, Mike.
Hello there.
Good. I wanted to, before we kind of dive into this, you know, I know that you look at the players and this kind of the kind of borderlines of the grey areas between what's cheating in one sport and slightly acceptable in another sport. But when we look at the world of sport and the governing bodies, I often wonder whether the kind of the air of cheating and why it feels acceptable to some sportsmen begins there. We look at the awarding, you know, you've been to Olympic Games, and we see the awarding of, you know, the World Cups. And there's a kind of, you know, there's a belief amongst all of the public that all of these events are slightly given out because of backhanders and cheating by the very authorities who are then somehow in charge of these, you know, Olympians and sportsmen. Do you think that there's a kind of view there is corruption from the top, and that's why it seems acceptable to people further down the line to cheat?
I wouldn't deny that there's corruption at the top. Although, you know, legalities might mean that I'd have to be a bit careful at exactly who I pointed the finger at. But I think it's generally generally acknowledge that, you know, at the top end, certain large events get given to certain countries, and it might, sometimes surprisingly, and you begin to wonder, well, how could that possibly have happened? I mean, could money perhaps have come into it, you know? But I think the point you make, is it sort of rotten from the top downwards? I don't necessarily think that's the case. I just think people are people, and they will bend the rules and they will cheat at times, whatever environment they're in. And if they happen to be a football player on the pitch, you might want to do something which the referee didn't see and maybe a camera wouldn't see either. Or if they're if they're an administrator who might just want to do something to tip a bid their way. I mean, it's well recorded that when Australia got the Sydney Olympics in 2000, they had to fight off a very strong bid from Beijing, and it all tipped by a matter of a vote or two, and that was sorted out by one of the Australian guys who took somebody out for a drink the night before the vote and promised them, and I think promised certain things to their family, and certain, you know, it wasn't illegal, it was a smart use of the maximum things you could do, and it was seen to have tipped the balance. I mean, it was a great games in Australia, and I'm very glad that that person did it. But you could say, well, that wasn't strictly a plain, pure thing to do. But these things happen in at the top end of sport. These things happen in life, and so it's just whether you're a sports administrator or whether you're a football player, you look at the rules and see if you can bend them or get around them as they present themselves to you.
Mike, I wonder, we're always kind of hung up on this idea, the word sporting, which is obviously to mean fair, and the idea of fair play and all the rest of it. Was there ever a sort of golden age for sport where it was always, everyone was always whiter than white, everyone kept within the kind of lines of the court? Or do we have kind of rose-tinted glasses, perhaps, when we look back, considering where we are at the moment with Lance Armstrong and these kind of big-name doping kind of legacies?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that is very simple. The answer is no. It's never been pure. The ancient Greeks ran the ancient Olympics, and the athletes, before they went into the stadium, would file past a series of statues which had been dedicated to Zeus, and they were paid for by people who had been found to have cheated, basically, at the Olympics. It mostly was a matter of bribery at that time. If they were found out, what they did was put on the front of a statue, and they had to pay for it to be there. So there it was, as a reminder to every athlete as they marched in. So that's ancient Greece. That's going back pretty far. And I think it's, you know, I couldn't speak for the Dark Ages, but I think probably people are much the same generation after generation. And
but I wonder if we have this idea. Maybe we're speaking to you in France. We're in a studio in London. Whether maybe it's this sort of post-war thing, this kind of 1950s idea of a sort of reclaimed innocence. I wonder whether you feel that on cricket pitches, football pitches, wherever it is, on the slalom ski slope, whether there was a more of a consensus maybe at times like that than that there have been through history in sport.
That's a difficult one to answer because, of course I'm not going to deny that there is a very idealistic streak that goes through a lot of sport and is entirely valid. The last thing I would want to suggest, or indeed have suggested in the book, I hope, is that everybody's at it and the whole thing's corrupt, because it's just, that's not the case. It's a balance, it's a mixture. There are true idealists, you know, in sport now. I honestly believe that, and I think there always have been. In terms of a post-war idea, I mean, I'm not quite sure where that consensus would come from. I mean, post-war, for instance, you know, there were some football matches when the Soviet Union sides came over and played European sides, and it was still pretty much the same kind of nationalistic expedition as it ever was. You know, national pride was tied into it. I'm not, you know, the idea of a pure sport. I mean, cricket. You know, the phrase "it's just not cricket." that's a phrase which makes you think.
Yeah,
Mike.
Cricket is a pure sport.
Mike, can I ask you? In the book, you have a big section on sumo wrestling and the corruption that was unearthed there. You know, this was a sport that was seen as, you know, a really central part of kind of Japanese culture. People were honoured. These were heroes for people. Once that kind of level of corruption has been discovered, does it change that game forever?
Well, I couldn't speak for people who follow Suma. I'm not a
but I wonder if it's the same for it's the same. I wonder with the Tour de France. We saw so much doping. I know that this year everyone said that nobody had kind of tested positive. But there's now just a feeling, I guess, amongst many people, they're probably using things you can't test for. That legacy seems to linger in some sports.
I mean, that's a very valid point of view. I think if you look at the patterns in sports, I mean, there have been patterns of doping. Well, you're on the subject of doping. Yes, cycling has had regular scandals, and it's a bit like the war to end all wars, isn't it? It'll all be over by Christmas, and guess what? It never is. But that doesn't necessarily... I would personally say I think it would be a shame, and I think it would be wrong to turn away from a sport. So it's a vast thing, just because such a lot of bad things have been going on. I mean, the classic point that's made by anybody who has to explain away a whole streak of positive tests in sport. It was advanced by cycling. It was advanced by athletics more recently when Asafa Powell and Tyson Gay were tested positive, and on the same day virtually the news came out. Bad news is good news, because guess what? If we didn't care and nobody was trying to find anything out, you'd never hear anything about it. And I think football has got a long way to go before it reaches the kind of levels of honesty and application that cycling and athletics are currently at. They suffer because they unearth cheats.
It rumbles on. Mike Rowbottom, author of Foul Play, The Dark Arts of Cheating in Sports. Thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly.
Cats have had a significant role in culture, and they have featured in quite a few songs as well, as this montage points out. See how many songs you can recognise.
It isn't Beethoven, Mama, but it sure bounces.
Say, this kid knows where it's at.
Knows where what's at?
Well, little lady, let me elucidate here. Everybody wants to be a cat, because a cat's the only cat who knows where it's at.
Tell me, everybody's picking up on that feline beat, because everything else is obsolete.
Strictly high button shoes.
Well, that was quite a lot of cats to spot. I don't think we're going to name them all. I think Rob was feeling that he'd got quite a few of them. Anyway, our next guest, John Bradshaw, is a world expert in animal behaviour and the interaction between animals and humans. He's already written a book on dogs and now has finished a follow-up about cats, Cat Sense. Fair enough, considering that nowadays cats outnumber even dogs by 3-1, making them the most popular pet.
John's written a portrait on cats, their nature, their history, and how better to understand them. And he joins us now on the Monocle Weekly. Welcome to the show, John. You were making a bit of a face while we had that montage. I know, because the book is obviously a serious treatise on the cat, and we feel like we've maybe sold it a bit light there. But I've got my first question has to be: I don't really like cats. What am I doing wrong?
Oh, you're not alone. I mean, about one person in five doesn't like cats, and one person in 20 actually feels physically repulsed by cats, as if they were a spider or a snake or something.
I've got a bit of a phobia. I basically am slightly scared of cats, and I always get scratched by them, and so it's kind of like a bit of a snowball effect. Is this a common thing?
It is reasonably common, yeah, and it's common all over the world. And if we can have a few minutes after the show, I'll interview you, because that's one of the things I've been studying is cat phobics and where it all came from. But There is a corresponding phobia for dogs, most people who have that can generally trace it back to being bitten by a dog when they were a kid or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas most people I've talked to about the cat one is they don't have any explanation for it. It's just I don't like the feel of cats. I don't like the look of them, and I've always been like that. So.
John, the book goes back right to our very early relationships with cats, and you say that it may have taken up to 5,000 years for failed attempts at kind of getting to know these cats and kind of bringing them into a domestic setting. Those original cats, were they kind of like, was there a small species of cat that kind of wandered around our countryside that we spotted? Were they wild across Europe even thousands of years ago?
They were wild across Europe and Asia, or at least Western Asia, thousands of years ago, and still are in smaller numbers. I mean, we still have them in Scotland, the Scottish wildcat. It's the same species as our domestic cat, although it lives a very different kind of a lifestyle. And what is now thought is that these cats, probably rather similar to the Scottish wildcat, but adapted to life in the Middle East, when human beings first started storing food, the house mouse evolved. It wasn't known before that, but it very quickly evolved to capitalise on the fact that we were putting food all in the same place. And the cats followed in. They came in and found good hunting around human settlements. And so that is gradually how the domestic cat evolved. First of all, it was just a hanger-on, rather like an urban fox today, perhaps.
And I think that the book kind of charts this kind of on-off relationship with cats in many ways, that at one point revered, obviously, the most famous example perhaps in ancient Egypt. But, I think right up in more recent times, you give an example of, cats being set on fire and cats being thrown off towers, that we're not quite sure what to make of them in many, as Rob says,
Now, I think we have had, as a human race in general, we've had an ambivalent relationship with cats, and sometimes the cat haters have had the upper hand, and at the moment, the cat lovers have the upper hand, especially, of course, on the internet, where you get all these cat memes and cat pictures and all sorts of things.
BuzzFeed wouldn't be the website it is today without 21 incredibly cute pictures of cats just for today.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And there is something about the cat's face, which in many people triggers feelings of kind of warmth and wanting to look after the animal, which means it works very well on the internet. Of course, that's not a real cat. And then there are people who really find them quite disturbing. And that, I think, is at the root of why, at some points in their history, cats have been associated with superstition and witchcraft and all that kind of thing, and with disastrous consequences if you happen to be the wrong cat at the wrong place at the wrong time.
The wrong cat, that's... Man, there needs to be a movie, doesn't there? The wrong cat at the wrong time. And that's the problem. Is that problem, having written a book on dogs as well before Cat Sense, John, is that problem that we anthropomorphize these animals and imbue them with what we feel are human traits, and if they don't live up to them, then we hate them or love them too much? Is that one of the problems?
I think that can be a problem. I mean, if we didn't anthropomorphize them at all, I suspect we simply wouldn't have them around. Mm. It's believing in one part of our minds that they are companions and little humans, I think is part of the bond that we feel with them. Otherwise, they'd just be another piece of consumer goods to be disposed of at whim.
I quite like, I mean, having said that, I have a genuine relationship with my Henry the Hoover. Not that kind of relationship. But a face on it, and I love it.
Now, tell me, with cats, we have this contemporary issue, which is that lots of cats, they never go outdoors. They live in people's apartments, and they're kept now in a way that we've never thought of keeping cats before. Is that cruel to cats, or do cats actually not mind actually being shut up in your apartment all day?
Cats don't seem to be particularly bothered about how much space they have, literally how many square feet. But what they are bothered about is having somewhere interesting to live. And in some senses, cats that are shut up indoors are protected from other cats. I mean, it's one of the main causes of stress for cats is the cat next door. Lots of cats get taken to the vet with a scratch or a bite that's gone septic. Quite a lot of cats get taken to the vet with skin problems or cystitis, which are probably traceable to the stress, at least the kind of flare-ups are traceable to the stress of having a bad relationship with the cat next door or even the cat in the same house. So a solitary indoor cat is not necessarily going to have a bad time, provided two things. One is that it has never really been outside, because we do think that cats can miss the freedom, and being cooped up, they find it very frustrating. And secondly, that there is, when the owners are home, which quite often they probably aren't, they they give the cat a good time. They play with the cat and they talk to the cat. And if provided the cat's well looked after, I don't see a problem.
Do cats like that as much as dogs being played with? Because they, I mean, we always, this is one of the reasons they don't like cats, because they always seem to, they want to bugger off.
Well,
I mean, you know, do you know what I mean? I don't feel that they have. They this is an age old thing. Maybe this is why people used to throw cats off buildings, as Andrew was saying.
Well, they do. They enjoy play.
Yeah,
yeah, they enjoy playing, but for a kind of a different reason, I think, for a dog. For a dog, a game is a game with the owner.
Yeah,
and if there's a toy involved, you know, if there's a tug toy or a ball or something involved, that's just kind of part of the game, and it enables the dog to get closer to the owner. For a cat, it's the toy is what the cat is focusing on. And as all the research we've done suggests that the cat thinks it's hunting at that point. It plays in exactly the same way as it would do if it was hunting. It plays more violently if it's hungry than if it's not, which is the kind of opposite of almost of what you might expect. And so for that and lots of other reasons, we think that for a cat, a game like that with a toy mouse on the end of a piece of string is a substitute for hunting. So that's why it's a good thing to do for an indoor cat that doesn't able to express that instinct in any other way.
There was an interesting TV program recently that was looking at the lives of cats, and especially kind of what they do at night when they kind of leave your home. And it turned out that they kind of wandered, some of them wandered huge distances and were kind of...
They're all cabbies, aren't they? That's why they're so tired all day. They're just doing some mini cabbing all over...
But is that sense of what cats do, is it still a mystery, that kind of the private lives of cats? You know, the ones that do get to go outdoors, we don't actually know how far they travel or kind of how they integrate with other animals, etc.
Well, increasingly technology is enabling us to get a window on that. And you can actually buy this stuff now and put it on your own cat. You don't have to sign up for a TV program. Okay. I get lots of emails from people who do and say, you know, oh, my cat's only getting 20 yards from my house. Is there a problem? And I'm going, no, that's great, because it's much less likely to be able to kill any wildlife if it only goes 20 yards from your house. The one thing we have found out, which we suspected for many years, but only with these sort of collars, these tracking collars and so on, is we now know that they go into people's houses a lot more than we thought they did. Mm. And cats are very wedded to their environment. It's their number one point of reference, if you like. They need a place where they can find food and somewhere comfortable to rest. And the attachment to the owner comes along afterwards, whereas with the dog, it's the other way around. And that's why you can walk dogs and you can't walk cats. When you walk a dog, the dog's world is on two legs walking around. When you try and walk a cat, it goes, actually, I live here. You can go off and do what you want, but I'm sticking here.
We talk about the domesticated dog, the domesticated cat, using those words kind of loosely. Which cat's wilder than dogs?
Absolutely. Cats are only half domesticated. I mean, most of the kittens you'll find at a animal shelter or whatever somewhere are the progeny of cats which have decided who the husband and wife, not to put too delicate a point on it, are going to be. So they make their own decisions about mating, which is basically a characteristic of a wild animal. In the West anyway, that really happens with dogs nowadays. People kind of plan when they're going to have puppies, even if the puppies are not pedigree. Whereas with cats, most of the kittens that most people have today are the product of marriages between consenting cats rather than consenting owners. So they've retained that piece of wildness. And of course, they like to hunt. I mean, it's something we've encouraged them to hunt for many thousands of years. And now suddenly, in the last 50, we go, oh, naturally, we don't.
Well, they're good. Farm cat. You see, the farm cat's a great cat, isn't it? That's the ideal cat, right?
Well, from a cat's point of view, a well-cared-for farm cat is probably living as close to what they've learned and adapted to over the last few thousand years as any other cat.
And are they responsible for decimating our, especially our bird life?
Well, cats bring home birds, dead birds, and people get very upset about that. But from the bird's perspective, birds, you know, most birds, most small garden birds produce far more young than they can ever survive. I mean, you know, 12 a year or something per pair. If all of those, so many of those offspring are doomed, essentially, or we've just been knee deep in them. And cats kind of help to hoover up the surplus. I mean, it's just an unfortunate fact of being a cat. Is that what you were, that is what your program to do? There was a report a couple of years ago. It said, you know, that blue tits were particularly a target of cats in Reading, where the study happened to have been done rather than anything to do with Reading, I suspect.
Yeah.
Suburban gardens, we should say. And but the population of that particular species is going up, not coming down. So whatever cats are doing, they're not having any kind of long-lasting effect in the United Kingdom. I'd say that the situation is different, say, in New Zealand or Australia. Where cats are alien species and can do a lot more damage because they don't have so many competitors. But over here, they're not actually very good at it, basically. They never really learn how to do it, and so they never have any major effect.
I like cats a lot more now.
Yes.
John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, The Feline Enigma Revealed. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Great pleasure.
And that is it. 217, edition 217 of Monocle Weekly comes to an end.
I liked John.
John was good with me, the cat thing. And I did genuinely like cats more, learning about them after that chat, than I started off.
Despite hinting to him that cats were out driving taxis, putting lipstick on.
Which is the way he described them. What do taxis do at night? And then he tells you. And then you're like, yeah, they sort of hang around. There's a lot. I saw some in the Middle East sort of hanging around. They sort of hang around restaurants and bars. What are you trying to say? They do choose their own mate, don't they? You can't just put two cats in a room. They'll probably fight.
You see, you're probably a bit more cat-like.
Yeah.
I think you're probably hanging around the back of the restaurant as
well. Is that what I'm doing?
Yeah.
I'm not putting lipstick on.
No, not putting lipstick on. Or driving a taxi.
No, people, this is we get the wrong idea. They'll think that I'm kind of like, what? I don't know what they'll think I am.
He doesn't wear lipstick.
No.
But he does hang around a bit. And at night, you're not quite sure how far he's wandered.
Exactly. I'm not doing any cabbying.
We're going to get a little bell for your neck. cut a little door in the front of Midori House for you to so you can sneak in.
Oh, I'm back. I'm a bit late. Sorry. Here I am. That was a good show. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I did.
Cheating in sport as well.
Yes.
It's like all cats play sport, isn't it? Cheating gene.
Again, not a really good book from Mike, and just that kind of. I think he's quite interesting because I don't think he thinks all cheating is kind of cheating. I think in the book he points out that, you know, like fouls in some sports would be acceptable in other sports.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
He kind of looks at the kind of the borderlines about what's acceptable and not acceptable as well. So a really good book.
It's going to be great. I think it's going to be balm to the vanity of our non-existent Monocle five-a-side football team. That's when it'll all come out.
Well, I'm serving the oranges. That's all I'm doing.
Exactly. I'll be mixing the Lucozade.
Okay.
I'll be standing on the sidelines in my lipstick. should we thank the people that made today's show, Andrew? It wasn't just us, was it?
Yeah, I'll thank Daniel Giacopelli.
I'm going to thank Marcus Hippie, who co-produced.
And Fernando Augusto Pacheco, or Augustus Pacheco, as it says here in the script.
Exactly.
He's gone posh.
He's suddenly been promoted to a Roman general there.
He was doing some nice research.
We should also thank Ed Lucas, Henrietta Landels, and Ilias Simos. And our manager today was Toby Hammond. There's quite a lot of people.
Do you know what? That's the last time you're going to say that.
Our studio manager today was Toby Hammond.
He's gone. It's the end of him.
Is he? Look, there he is. Just a pair of shoes.
He's off to run a cafe.
Really?
Yeah.
Where's the cafe? Where's that going to be?
You might be hanging around the back of it, I think.
God.
But we'll tell people on another show.
Okay, let's save
he's got, he's got to make it a success first, and then he can come back and be entrepreneurs.
Okay, cool. So it remains only really for me, or Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
To say thanks for tuning in.